Good afternoon, everyone. This is an informal hearing of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. I'm Randy Christman, Chair, joined by Commissioners Sherry Haugen-Hoffert and Julie Fedorchek. This is the Otter Tail Power Integrated Resource Plan informal hearing. It's case number PU-21-380. A lot of people in the room. I don't know if everybody is potentially going to talk, but just not at the table. I'd like to just have everybody go around the room and introduce yourselves into the microphone so we have a record of it. But first, before we do that, I just wanted to inquire of each of you. Commissioner Fedorchek, did you have any opening comments or anything you wanted to get out of the way?
Well, I have to make a couple opening comments just because it's so exciting to be having our very first kind of formal discussion about an integrated resource plan since we passed the law. This is our first one. Mm-hmm. So it's been a little bit of a herky-jerky start due to a lot of different factors. But we sought the authority to do a more in-depth review, and I think your case in particular, I think, spells out the need for us to do that. Not that it's, somehow super controversial, although it kind of is. But it's just such a dynamic time, and things are changing so quickly that it's really easy to get swept up into the minute, the things that are burning today, like this ADP or, that rider, and those are all things that are just looking at now. But what we really need to be doing is looking at the future now and the future, making sure we have enough resources to cover our bases now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, etc. And so I'm really glad that we are taking time in the calendar, forcing us to stop and do this sort of look. I know you guys do it all the time. Now we're going to do it with you a little bit. And I'm looking forward to having this discussion with all of you about some really important subjects. So thank you.
Okay. So why don't we get everybody's name on the record and then turn it over to you for opening comments because it's your portfolio and you can just...
Julie took my comment, so that's okay.
Oh, okay. I'll still turn it over to you at the right time. So if we can just go around the room and have everyone identify themselves.
And could I ask that you say your title, too, just for the record, please?
Carrie Stephenson, Associate General Counsel, Otter Tail Power Company.
Nate Jensen, Manager of Resource Planning, Otter Tail Power.
Mark Toma, Manager of Environmental Services with Otter Tail Power Company.
Adam Renfin, staff.
Brian Johnson, staff.
Victor Shook, PSC staff.
John Shook, PSC staff.
Bill Swanson, Manager of Supply Planning and Operations.
Matt Olson, Otter Tail Power Company, Manager of Regulatory Strategy and Compliance.
Brad Tollerson, Otter Tail Power Company, Vice President of Energy Supply.
Dean Lee, Otter Tail Power Company, Resource Planning.
Okay. Chris, I know where you're sitting there.
Chris Hansen, PSC staff.
Lee Clark, PSC staff.
Okay, then before I do turn it over to you, I just want to emphasize this is an informal hearing, so we'll be dealing in only undisputed details. If there is anything that comes up that is disputed, we'll have to issue a notice of hearing, and the applicant goes first and be really the only ones besides staff. But Commissioner Haugen-Hoffert, anything before we kick it off?
No, I think Julie summarized it very well. This is our first IRP. We look forward to working through this with you. I'm sure there will be a lot of questions as we move forward. There's some unknowns still. When I went through it again this weekend looking at MISO and their seasonal constraints and things that MISO has to decide and and all that. So I look forward to the dialogue. I'm sure there'll be some tough questions and maybe some unknown answers to that. So that will be ongoing. The only thing I have to add, if those of you on Otter Tail, if you're sitting on the side and you end up answering a question, if you would kind of come up to the table and make sure you have a mic so we can and hear that. So it looks like Otter Tail has a PowerPoint to go through. The only thing I would ask is when I turn it over to you is if we have questions, if you want us to ask at that time or if you want us to wait until kind of the end. I will ask you on how you prefer.
You can ask questions anytime.
Okay. So I'll turn it over to you.
All right, I'll kick things off. Thank you, commissioners. Again, I'm Nate Jensen with Otter Tail Power. Joking with Adam that these slides have only taken us about 2 years to develop.
This IRP should be really good then.
Yeah. I noticed there's no date on it.
Yeah. This IRP has been quite the marathon. You know, we'll get into it more in details. A lot has changed since we started this process. Happy to be here at this point. Excited about the content we have to share today. Kick things off here. Here's just an overview. Let's start off some broad information about Otter Tail. Get into the procedural history, what got us to this point. Talk about our supplemental preferred plan, and then get into some split system modeling. There's some slides in here on that. Mark will give us an environmental regulation update, and then we'll close off with just a couple important dates looking ahead. Key takeaways. First one should be no surprise to everyone in this room. Long-term resource planning continues to be challenging, and it hasn't slowed down in this pace, this resource transition that we're in as an overall industry. It's creating a lot of things we haven't seen before. And, you know, for Otter Tail specific, we look at our jurisdictional differences. You know, that's not getting any easier. We look at different policy decisions that our states are making. And, you know, we're at a point now where we think that bifurcated resource planning is going to be necessary moving forward. And, you know, the future of coyotes, a real important issue with this IRP. And it's, you know, we have a, you know, potential plan moving forward where the future of coyote operational characteristics are going to look different for our different jurisdictions. And then, again, no surprise to you, federal environmental rules continue to pose challenges. Kick it over to Carrie now for a few slides.
Let's see if I can goof that up. Statement true. Just a real brief recap about Otter Tail, who we are and what we do. Our mission is to produce and deliver electricity as reliably, economically, and environmentally responsibly as possible to the balanced benefit of our customers, our shareholders, and employees, and to improve the quality of life in the communities we serve. And it's really about finding that balance, and then we really do focus on our communities. And we serve, I think everyone's aware, a very large area. It's roughly the size of Wisconsin is our service territory in Minnesota, western Minnesota, North Dakota, and the northeastern portion of South Dakota. And we have about 132,000 customers. It's a big service territory, but not a lot of customers. And they're roughly evenly split between Minnesota and North Dakota. We have about 59,000 customers in North Dakota, 62,000 in Minnesota, and about 11,000 in South Dakota. And communities, we serve small communities, 420 communities throughout this area. About 245 of those are in North Dakota, and the average size of the communities we serve in North Dakota is about 240 people, so small towns. And Jamestown, in fact, is our biggest community across our entire system. I think the population there is about 16,000, and that is our biggest community. The only other towns that exceed 10,000 in our whole system are Fergus Falls and Bemidji in Minnesota. On the PowerPoint, our current system, the resources we have, I think most people are generally aware of, we have two coal-fired baseload units. Of course, we have Coyote Station near Beulah, Big Stone Plant in South Dakota on the Minnesota border. We have five major wind farms, all in eastern North Dakota, Miracourt being the most recent build. That's 150 megawatt farm. I think the total nameplate capacity of our wind farms is about 350 megawatts in eastern North Dakota. We also have five peaking plants, the most recent of which is Astoria Station, which, of course, is subject to an ADP. And I told Brian before the start of the hearing here, I'm not going to do any advocacy, but there are components of this where we have to reference Astoria Station. Jamestown, we have a couple of oil peakers, same at Lake Preston in South Dakota, and then we have another natural gas turbine, a small one near Solway, Minnesota, in northwest Minnesota. We still have hydroelectric facilities along the Otter Tail River, and those were just renewed for another 40 years, small but really part and parcel of our history. And we have one significant solar facility, Hoot Lake Solar in Fergus Falls, just a little bit under 50 megawatts. And the costs of Hoot Lake Solar are all allocated to Minnesota, as are the benefits. And then just a couple of very small demonstration solar facilities. So that makes up our system, our generation portfolio as it exists today.
Terry, how big did you say your hydro in Minnesota is?
Oh, gosh. It's small.
Yeah, there's five individual units along the Otter Tail River, totaling about 2.5 megawatts.
Oh, wow. So your Minnesota generation is the solar, the hydro. Was there some fuel oil on it?
We have a natural gas simple cycle turbine in Solway, Minnesota. It's 50 megawatts.
50, okay. Yep. Thanks.
The procedural history, we filed our IRP on September 1st, 2021, so a couple of years ago, and change, and we're still going. And as has been noted, I think we were the very first utility to file under the new statutes. The statutes became effective, I believe, August 1st of 21, and we filed 30 days later. And we didn't have the benefit, of course, to have the rules that detail the content of the filings. Those went into effect, I believe, January 1st of 23. So we've been working with staff, trying to make sure they have the information they need to assess our IRP. And the next go-around, of course, we'll have the benefit of the rules and be able to conform our IRP to those. Our initial filing, and we filed in all three states pursuant to statute, the new statute in North Dakota, the standard statutory process in Minnesota. And then in South Dakota, they don't have an IRP process, but we nonetheless filed there for informational purposes. our preferred plan in our initial filing had three key points. One was Astoria dual fuel. That's how we characterized it at that time. We weren't sure what that fuel source would be, whether fuel oil or liquefied natural gas or something else. We proposed adding solar generation, 150 megawatts, by 2025. And then our modeling indicated that it was cost-effective to withdraw from our 35% ownership interest in Coyote Station in the 2028 timeframe. So that was part of our initial filing, the three key components.
By what year on Coyote?
I'm sorry, Commissioner.
By what year on Coyote?
In the 2028 time frame. There wasn't a hard and fast date there, but in that general time frame.
Okay.
Well, of course, as things go, after we made our filing, it seemed the world got turned on its head. There were a lot of significant changes that affect resource planning that occurred not long after we had made that filing. One of which, let's see, doing this for me. Thank you. All right, I didn't notice that. One of which we had some loading additions on our system that occurred or became known to us after that filing. Of course, a very significant item was the passage or the enactment of the Federal Inflation Reduction Act and the incentives it provided for various renewables. It's hard to overstate the importance of the changes that have occurred or still occurring at MISO. And I think we all anticipated the change to a seasonal capacity construct. I think, though, no one really anticipated the reserve planning margins that MISO had put forward, particularly for the winter season, and we're a winter peaking utility. So that That was a very significant development after we had filed that initial plan. Winter Storm Elliott reinforced some of our thinking about fuel assurance for our generation resources. And then in early of 2023, Minnesota passed some legislative changes that affect resource planning, and obviously those reflect some different policy prerogatives between our states. So when we looked at all of those issues, we concluded that we needed to supplement our initial filing, and that would include updating our modeling to account for these changes. And, excuse me, before detailing that, Nate's going to address just some of the significance of the Inflation Reduction Act.
Can I just, before you go there, Carrie, can I ask a question about Minnesota and the policy stuff?
Sure.
So they increased their commitment to going carbon-free in the last legislative session, which was after all the problems of Storm Uri, the problems that MISO was seeing, the warning signs from MISO. So help me understand what the utilities did during the last legislative session to try to educate the Minnesota policymakers about the real world and then the world that they're living in, which don't seem to be the same. And, you know, meanwhile, they're getting more aggressive. And everyone else is going, whoa, we've gone too far already. Like, yeah, the world got turned up on our heads, but we did it. We just went down this path too fast. And the policymakers don't seem to be understanding that. And somehow, all of us in this sector, we need to change that. We have to get these people on the same page. So some of that is us, the regulatory community, but some of it is you guys, too. Were you engaged? What's going on in the Minnesota legislature to kind of support that kind of policy development?
Commissioner Fortek, it's a little difficult for me to speak, you know, what drives Minnesota policy. I do know, I think you're familiar with the folks that speak to our, like Mark Brink and others. And we try to be respectful of the policy prerogatives of our states. I'm sure Mark and his team have candid conversations with legislators who we want them to understand, particularly our perspective, where we serve three different states, and we have to try and bridge these differences as best we can. So we provide information. I can't give you the chapter and verse for what was discussed. We can provide that information after the hearing, if that would be helpful. But I do know we are engaged with those legislators, as we are here when the session is going on. And we do try to emphasize, you know, we're different than other utilities that they regulate. There's really a remarkable difference in Minnesota. We're a fraction of the size of XL, and we serve small communities throughout western Minnesota and the rest of our states. And it's a little different equation when you do that. We have different systems. We have different priorities as a utility, perhaps. And I'm not sure what else I can provide you at this setting, but we're sensitive to it, we understand, but at the same time, we're trying to be respectful and honor the policy choices among our states.
Okay, well, that's fine, but I also think you have a responsibility to reliable and affordable power everywhere. And if policymakers are going down a path that is taking and making it hard for you to provide that, I think they need to know that. And that goes beyond being polite and respectful. It means, like, we got to tell them. This doesn't work. Here's what MISO's saying. Here's what the NERC is saying. Here's what we're seeing. Here's what we've already seen. And so they get that real flavor versus we'll do whatever you say and we'll, you know, try our best to make it work. But if it doesn't work, then, you know, who's to blame? They're out of touch, the policymakers at the state level in many, many states across this country, and the utilities have got to get more serious about delivering that message to them. So maybe you can take that back to your higher-ups, and you can be assured that I have these conversations with XL a lot as well, so I'm not just beating you guys up.
I have a couple questions. As I was reading this, you've alluded to it.
Thank you, both of you. As I was reading this, and you've alluded to it here, the Inflation Reduction Act, and I'm going to, what really struck out to me was your letter on March 31st, 2023, the second bullet. It says the enactment of the Federal Reduction Act, which provides renew incentives for wind, solar, et cetera. And I stopped and I said, if not, if this didn't come about, what was your plan? And are some of them still viable? And if you're going to answer that, you know, this created a lot of opportunity. And I think we're seeing that already up there in that slide. But if it wasn't for this, what was the plan? And is it still viable? Kind of going back to what some of the points that Julie's trying to say. So I just want to know, are we giving up opportunities because of this Inflation Reduction Act? And then my other question is, you indicated, you said you bridge between three states. How do you do that? How do you, what does that mean for you? So those are kind of two questions, and if you're going to address it later down or with this, maybe I'm going to get my question, but how do you bridge between us three states and meeting our goals and our concerns?
Commissioner, I think we do have some slides coming that will address that specific question of how we try to bridge between our states when we have these different policy prerogatives. On your first question, what changed with the IRA? We'll come to that, too, but I think our initial plan, of course, that was pre-IRA, so that was our initial look at what the modeling would suggest. What we saw with the IRA, with these renewed incentives and new incentives, is that it pulled in our modeling, more renewables, but it shoved them back further in time. And we're duty-bound with these federal legislative changes to take a look at that and to assess what is workable, what is going to be pulled in through the modeling, what is going to be cost-effective for our customers. So with our supplemental plan, we incorporated those differences, and we'll come to that in a minute to show what the result of that supplemental modeling looked like.
And I just thought, Julie asked such an important question, I think. And I just want to say, in North Dakota, it's been primarily through an affiliate with you and the other utility companies. And a lot of the lobbying has been done through the utility shareholders in North Dakota. So I don't know what has happened in Minnesota, whether it's through you as an individual company or some type of an affiliate like that. I don't know if there is something like that in Minnesota. But I will tell you, Otter Tail, as well as XL and MDU through utility shareholders, I've seen you guys lobby very, very aggressively on issues you really care about. And so I, too, am curious about what kind of efforts have been made to influence policy in Minnesota.
Commissioner, I think Brad Tollerson's going to speak to this.
Okay. Yeah, Brad Tollerson with Otter Tail Power. In the Minnesota legislative session, we did have a very active lobbying effort. We were speaking with the authors of the bill. I testified. Our manager of legislative affairs testified, raising concerns about carbon-free legislation in the state, as did the other utilities to varying degrees. So we were very active in the Minnesota legislative session.
And was the testimony that, yeah, if you do this, I guess we'll just close our coal plant and build more solar?
Or
were you clear that things like Uri and Elliott are going to become more and more frequent, or we'll just
have to find
something that's so far undiscovered and unproven?
No, we clearly raised issues about the reliability of the system as the system changes and the pace of change. So very much a part of our testimony and comments.
We'll keep it up.
All right.
Hopefully there won't be any more examples this winter.
All right. All right, I'll hop back into the presentation here.
Yeah.
Okay, so as Carrie mentioned, you know, one of those big changes was the passing of the Inflation Reduction Act. That was in August of 2022. Now, when you step back and you look at, you know, the capacity expansion modeling that goes into an IRP, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of inputs that go into the model. But there are, you know, a handful of inputs that we would say it has the most, the highest likelihood of driving results, the biggest impact of results. And the cost assumptions of your replacement resource is one of those inputs that's very important. And, you know, prior to the IRA, we were assuming tax credits would expire in 2026. The IRA extended that through at least 2032, and it increased them, both the PTC and the ITC. You can see here, you know, for wind, we're looking at a $15 per megawatt hour reduction as a direct result of the IRA. For solar, we're seeing an $8 per megawatt hour reduction. That was something worthwhile for us to reevaluate. And Commissioner Haugenhofer, to your question, those resources that showed up in our initial filing, mm-hmm. you know, you look at our supplemental preferred plan, as Mr. Stephenson alluded to, increased renewables but delayed. So those resources still make sense as part of the IRA. Now there's a longer roadway to get those resources developed and in service, so it pushed those back. Rather than trying to get those in to capture that tax credits before the 2026 expiration. Any other questions on that?
As we were saying, the changes that occurred since we filed our initial plan were so significant that we then filed a supplement to that plan in March of 2023. And the supplemental preferred plan replaced our initial preferred plan. And the key points of that supplemental plan was the addition of on-site liquefied natural gas at a storage station. We drilled down into determining what was the best fuel source. Astoria Station is a natural gas turbine, so it's really the same fuel source. So sometimes you'll hear it described as dual fuel. I think being it's the same fuel source, it's probably more accurately characterized as on-site storage of that fuel. As Nate indicated, the modeling pulled in more renewable resources, but later. 200 megawatts of surplus solar, and then 200 megawatts of wind. And then Coyote Station was obviously one of the most significant issues, or is the most significant issue potentially in our filing. And when we assessed all of the changes that had occurred and the uncertainty that was coming from MISO because of these capacity construct changes and the reserve planning margins, the still open questions about accreditation, increasingly emphatic calls from officials at FERC and MISO about the pace and scope of baseload retirements. When we considered the volatility we had seen in markets, when we considered to what degree the things that were occurring at capacity auctions and all the things that we have observed, the things that have changed, we reassessed Coyote Station. And it wasn't a wholesale change, it was a modification. And our supplemental preferred plan seeks authority to withdraw from Coyote Station only in the event that a large non-routine capital investment is required to comply with the most likely scenario would be environmental compliance. But something that is not part and parcel of the capital outlays that we make every year for the safe and reliable operation of the plant. It made sense to us to step back and let things come into focus during this transition and rely upon the capacity value that Coyote presents as a dispatchable resource. It's a low-cost hedge. And to wait and see, essentially.
What is surplus solar?
That is solar that's built right on site sharing and interconnection with an existing resource. So if you have a natural gas plant, say that's 100 megawatts, you know, in theory you could put in 100 megawatts of surplus solar at that site. So the important part to consider is that the total output can exceed 100 megawatts. So it just a way
to. So it runs when it runs, and then otherwise, if you need it, you use the gas.
Yeah, it's a great option today when you look at the congestion in the MISO queue. That it takes years and years, and it's very expensive to build what's called a generic resource. That's a term we use where a resource goes through the queue, gets an interconnection, and it is standalone.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's one of the alternatives, that and replacement resources is another new option. And that's what we use for Hoot Lake Solar. Where you take a resource that's retiring, and rather than forfeiting those interconnection rights, you have 3 years to reuse those.
And I don't, because I wouldn't really understand them without giving it a lot of thought, so I'm not looking for the details now, but in your modified IRP, does it explain what large non-routine capital investments are, or is that just a catchphrase for whatever you want it to mean in the future?
Commissioner Christman, no, we did address that in our supplemental filing. We don't have a dollar threshold that, on this side of it, it's non-routine, on this side of it's routine. It's more, you look at the purpose and then the overall size. For example, Bill Swanson would tell you the co-owners of Coyote do planning, and they look out, is it about a decade, I think, and they look back at what does it cost each year for the safe and reliable operation of the plant. And there's a benchmark that goes with that. You can look at that data. Something that would be above an order of magnitude beyond that, I'm not sure the quantitative amount, but there's a qualitative aspect to it as well, that it's not for the safe and reliable operation. It would be something that is non-routine, that it would be for some significant compliance-driven event. And that's how we've characterized it in our comments.
So that begs the question, that event happened in May with the EPA rules, if that was to go forward, right?
I'm sorry, Commissioner Fedorchak.
The EPA greenhouse gas rules would be exactly that, if they are approved as they stand today or even close to how they stand today. So how do you evaluate that? Maybe that's the end of that's getting to the end of the presentation, so we can wait with that if you want.
Sure, they want to save the big finish on environmental rules for me, but clearly when you start talking about, the proposed greenhouse gas rule, that would, compel installation of, say, carbon capture and sequestration by 2030 if you wanted to continue operation out into the future.
Yep.
That would be one example. Talk a little bit more about regional haze as well as a potential another option. We haven't seen anything proposed yet on that front. So,
and the CCR doesn't affect Coyote?
So CCR, coal combustion residuals, certainly, it does impact Coyote, but in terms of, the future of investment to continue generation, it actually doesn't impact it, right? It's kind of revolves around management of the most recent role is management of what's called legacy CCR. We did already make some upgrades to that system as part of the initial CCR rule, so we converted any type of wet ash handling to a dry ash handling, so we're already compliant with the 2015 CCR rule, and then the one that's currently under consideration, even though potentially could require something at some point in the future, wouldn't impact, whether or not continued operation of the site.
So you're compliant to the newest rules that they're looking at? So I thought they are forcing people beyond the 2015.
Yeah, so the newest one they're looking at would really impact if you have any type of historical coal ash on site. And so certainly we'll have to comply with that regardless of whether or not Kyle Station continued operation. If it were finalized, we'd be installing potentially additional groundwater monitoring. Okay. And from there, depend on, but it would be regardless of whether or not Kyle Station continued operation or not.
So that falls in the more routine bucket.
It would not fall into the bucket that Mr. Stephenson is talking
about.
Yeah,
got it. So if you move forward with Coyote under this plan, what would be the, barring like early retirement, what's the established retirement date for Coyote?
The end of 2040.
Okay. So yeah, you'd be in that, the category that if you went about plans as they exist today, the EPA would have you putting on carbon capture and storage by 2030. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, again, that's if you wanted to kind of continue operation as is beyond 2030.
Right.
And beyond, yep.
But that was your original plan back in the day. 2040 was how long it was expected to run. Yeah.
That's the current depreciable life is 2040. Yeah.
Okay. Have you guys started to model any other replacements for that? Or how do you deal with that now with this plan?
In this IRP, we actually did a full set of runs with Coyote in service through 2040, and then did a full set of runs with Coyote withdrawing at the end of 2028. And so depending on the sensitivity, that replacement resource looked different.
Sure.
But in most cases, it was a wind primary replacement. With
Seriously? All wind?
With our capacity need isn't there. So without Coyote's capacity, we're still about flush. So the model is mostly replacing the energy.
How are you meeting your winter capacity need without Coyote?
Wind right now, with these new rules of MISO, is getting a substantial amount of capacity credit. We still have, Big Stone, Astoria Station, which in the wintertime is 285 megawatts.
Okay.
We've got 75 megawatts of oil peakers. We've got 50 megawatts at Solway. So we still do have a large number of dispatchable resources.
So your capacity need is more in the summer?
Our capacity need is higher in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, and again, this is very fluid, with the new rules MISO is unrolling. That could change, but, after, at least when we did our modeling for the supplemental plan, withdrawing from Coyote put us just about flush on a system-wide basis, and then those new renewables are picking up any small need in the future.
Okay. Even with solar getting almost zero credit in the winter.
That is correct, yeah. Yeah, because wind, I think, I think we were assuming wind in the wintertime right around 40% capacity credit, and that steps down to a low about 20% when we get out to the mid-30s. And that lines up with the estimates from MISO.
It's still a very risky scenario because that's what they're estimating today. But, maybe technologies will get better and they'll be able to incorporate more, or maybe this stuff will be worth less and less as you get more higher penetrations on the system.
And this is exactly why we did adjust our stance on Coyote in the supplemental plan. We saw some of these, uncertainties arise, and we've seen some large increases to our load forecasts. And, there are more futures where it makes sense for Otter Tail to remain in Coyote than there were 2.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still at a point where, putting a large capital investment, there would likely be a more cost-effective alternative than that. There are some sensitivities where the model is picking up a CT. And, the model is also, with current battery pricing that we're seeing and projecting in the future, there's a small amount of battery storage starting to show up in our summer modeling runs as well.
And the How does the modeling deal with transmission availability or lack thereof?
For new resources, we have a interconnection adder. So there is an assumed cost associated with constructing that new resources directly attributed to those transmission upgrades that would be required.
Just for the interconnection or for the building of the actual line?
For the interconnection, which accounts for those, the necessary upgrades. And the exception, again, as we already talked about, is those surplus and replacement resources. There's no interconnection adder.
It assumes that the lines are there, though, right? It assumes
correct.
That the LRTPs are built or
yep,
whatever.
Yep, that's correct.
So those costs are not obviously incorporated into the IRP.
That is correct, yeah. And those costs will be there regardless of what happens with those resources in our IRP.
Well, it's kind of, it's circular.
Yeah.
Because the resources in the IRP are driving the need for the lines.
That's very correct,
like
point.
Where it all comes around. All right.
All right. Moving on in the presentation here. So we'll get into some more modeling here next couple slides. But, it's important, this first bullet point. These new renewables that we have in our supplemental preferred plan, these weren't driven by any specific state policy. These were driven by modeling. We look at North Dakota prohibits us from looking at externalities. Minnesota requires it. So we do, not only did a full set of runs with and without coyote, and we did that again with and without externalities, just to make sure we're getting a broad look at all these different required modeling looks. And then we find that balance. So the without externalities was picking up renewables at the very end of the IRA. With externalities, we're picking up right away. So there was a we use the word compromise or a blend to spread those out, move some of those renewables up compared to the no externality runs.
Nate, again on the modeling, so you've got the no externalities, the model's picking up the renewables. I'm assuming it's largely because of the IIJA, the tax credits.
The IRA, yeah.
IRA and IIJA. Okay, so the tax credits are driving or making those very low cost.
Correct, yep.
How does the model consider the seasonal construct and the pros and cons of, say, like, okay, you do need a certain amount of solar in Minnesota, but that would be in the externalities case, I'm assuming. Solar is valuable in the summer. It's almost worthless in the winter. The winter accreditation is low and the planner reserve margin is high. So the part that it always concerns me that you could meet the needs in the winter with the CT because it gets high accreditation, you have to have it or some of it. And then you could just use that in the summer versus building the solar tube.
So
the double building for some of those. How do we know that isn't somehow hidden in these plans?
Yeah, I think I can answer that question. The model that we use, there's two primary targets. There's that capacity need, which we do have the seasonal construct in the model. We have a seasonal PRMR planning reserve margin requirement for each year. And then each resource has a seasonal accredited value. So for each season, how much capacity credit does that get? So the model goes through and solves for that capacity need. And then it goes through and it solves for the energy need on top of that. And what it's doing is trying to find that optimal solution. What's the least cost way to meet both the capacity and energy need? So what you're seeing with some of this new solar, although it's not helping us meet our wintertime capacity need, it is offsetting some market purchases. It's providing us cost certain peak energy that is driving down the revenue requirements in the model.
Do you run an energy, do we require an energy model, North Dakota? Versus just capacity?
We do.
So that we get the lowest cost, is that why, Adam?
Right.
Okay. Yep. And so what you're saying is the blend of those two for us gets us the capacity needed at the lowest cost.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. Yeah. That's helpful.
And, you know, again, we've been working on this for a couple of years and recognize that, you know, as our state's continuing down different paths, that, you know, historically we've been able to find that middle ground, but that's becoming almost too challenging. And before we get into the next slide, this is our supplemental preferred plan modeling. I don't know, do you guys have...
Are we getting copies of this?
That's in our stuff, that one.
But I mean, you're just the handouts from today.
I bring some extras. We can get you a paper copy right now.
Perfect.
This is hard to see from a distance. But this is the modeling that went into the supplemental preferred plan. So, you know, we did a whole ton of sensitivities. Right now, we're just focusing on the base case, which is our best guess at what the future is going to look like. And we run the model, pick the optimal solution, again, to meet those capacity and energy needs. So on the left, this is the assumption that Otter Tail withdraws from Coyote in 2028. You'll notice our no externality runs is picking up a substantial amount of renewables later on. You know, compared to the with externalities on the right, which is grabbing a lot of renewables right away. And Commissioner Haugenhofer, to your question earlier, how do we balance the different states? Mm-hmm. You know, this right here is a representation of that. We have our, you know, the Dakotas prefer us to look at this no externality column. Minnesota would prefer we look at this with externalities column. And try to find that, where do some of those resources match? And in this case, quantities aren't too far off, it's the timing, so we stepped that in. And then if you look at, if Coyote stays in service through 2040, you know, there's a much fewer renewables being selected in the no externalities, but there still is a pretty good chunk out there in that last year of the IRA benefits. And then Minnesota's picking up fair amount. So we, in that green box, we're calling that our action window. These are resources that we came to the conclusion this is what we want to move forward with regardless of what happens at Coyote. You know, and those resources in red on the left, those were the ones that were dependent on a Coyote withdrawal. Mm-hmm. But knowing that, you know, states are looking at this differently, on this next slide here, I'll just jump right into this. This is what it looks like if we were to take North and South Dakota together, which represents just a hair over half of our load, and run a model with looking at just the Dakotas and staying in Coyote through 2040 and through 2028. You know, we did something try not to get into too much details here, but we did two different looks. This on the left, this is our March supplemental filing renewable price assumptions. We've seen those prices come up a little bit since then, so we did want to rerun that model to make sure that we're capturing that. So we're assuming surplus solar at around $40, wind at around $35. So if you look at that third column, North and South Dakota with Coyote through 2040, our wind repowers are assumed. The model still is selecting new renewables, but it's not until 2031 that 50 megawatts of wind is being selected. Another 50 in 2032 with 50 megawatts of surplus solar. And then if we do withdraw from Coyote, again, looking at just North and South Dakota, the model is picking up that 200 megawatts of wind as the primary replacement for Coyote. And if you are...
So can I rephrase this?
Sure.
Going back to my one question at the beginning, maybe I asked it wrong, just from my own understanding. So in your first filing in March 2023, you had bringing on 25 megawatts of surplus solar in 2028, correct?
So this is just North and South Dakota modeling.
Right.
In our March filing, we did just our total system. Okay. So I can see that it's kind of confusing. There's a lot of different levers here that we're pulling and moving, but this is just the Dakotas, and this is using the March 2023 renewable price assumptions, which have changed. So then we're providing an updated with new renewable price assumptions. And the goal of this slide is just to show that the Dakota only modeling, it is still selecting renewables as part of a least cost plan. Again, a lot of it's for that energy need, but it is delaying it. Where when you look at, you go to the appendix, the very last page, this is what just Minnesota looks like. And this was a table from our October 30th reply comments that we filed in that docket in Minnesota. And again, you look at the old externalities of Minnesota. As a side note, just changed the externality rules. They increased those based on EPA societal cost of carbon estimates. When you look at that Minnesota with new externalities, it's grabbing a lot of renewables right away. And looking at those differences, knowing that our various commissions are feeling different about these renewable additions. Moving forward in future IRPs, we are going to propose bifurcated resource planning to where each state will get to decide on its own what resources to serve that state's load.
So you just split them.
Yeah, it's not a full split, but we're going to split the model for resource planning purposes. So we'll be able to, if Minnesota sees value in adding a certain type of resource at a certain time, we can do that for Minnesota customers. And if North Dakota sees a certain type of resource being valuable at a certain time, we can do that for North Dakota customers.
And then when it comes to the paying for those resources, how will you do that?
Those costs will be transferred to the customers in those specific states.
So it's not really an integrated system?
In some aspects, it still will be integrated. Our existing resource fleet will continue to operate the same way. Those costs will be allocated the same way. And for new resources, if it works out that both states agree that we want our share of this resource, we're not opposed to that. But in the likelihood that one state wants a resource, the other state does not, those costs associated with that resource will go directly to those customers and the benefit as well. And it's, with Hoot Lake Solar, the way it works, Hoot Lake Solar is still modeled as a system-wide resource. And then there's some calculating goes on behind the scenes to make sure those costs are covered by costs and the benefits are captured by Minnesota rates. Going forward, we would work with MISO to create different asset owners in their model. So we would have certain generators that would be OTP Minnesota, potentially, certain generators that could be OTP North Dakota, and then the accounting side of things is more straightforward, and MISO handles the dispatch, and those costs would be straightforward to track.
Mm. So regarding the integrated part that you said, the existing resources would continue to be integrated as they have been. I don't understand really Minnesota's all the details of their new requirements. Under their new requirements, could you run the Coyote plant through 2040?
Technically, as the rules are written, yes. The carbon-free standard requires renewable energy credits equal to 80% of your retail sales by 2030, 90% by 2035, and then 100% by 2040. So you need enough renewable generation to match your retail sales. It doesn't prohibit you from generating with thermal resources. And Coyote's a unique resource right now, especially in this IRP. It's got a lot of scrutiny. And we are looking at an approach where with Coyote is the one exception where we do split that in the MISO model, and we allow Minnesota to determine how it wants its share of coyote to be dispatched, and North Dakota to determine how it wants its share to be dispatched.
But are those IRP requirements part of what's driving the cost of operating it up so much?
The IRP, or you mean the carbon-free standard requirements? Or?
The renewable energy credit requirements, that's what I'm
No, that doesn't impact the dispatch costs or the cost of thermal units at all. What doesn't impact those are you know, the required regulatory cost of carbon that's in our model, and then those externality values that get added on to that, that impacts the cost of thermal units.
For your planning purposes.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. So we will have two separate models, is what we're proposing, a North and South Dakota model, and then a Minnesota model. So we take our resources that are shared, you know, make sure those are accounted for properly in the model, and then allow those models to pick what is the least cost way to serve the remainder of the load.
And just to emphasize, this is bifurcated resource planning. We're not looking at any separate operating companies for Minnesota, North Dakota, or any kind of other things that you may have addressed with our utilities. So this is really looking at each state from a planning perspective, mm-hmm. and we're still one system. And as far as the RECs, I would add, the statute itself, that's one of the things that I can add was part of the lobbying effort was the carbon-free standard does have an alternative compliance aspect. You can utilize RECs for that. The Minnesota Commission has a docket set up later this year to implement what that'll look like. So we're just basing straight off what the statute says, and there'll be more developments in that area as we go forward.
So is it feasible that you could, that Minnesota would basically pay for its audit or coyote through RECs, like that, or buy, like,
so
you're going to use it to meet the capacity needs for Otter Tail, I would assume. How do you do that requirement with MISO then? You know, do you have separate?
So the carbon-free standard doesn't prohibit us from owning and operating thermal generation. We just need to have enough renewable generation or supplement with renewable energy credits to offset our retail sales. So the way Minnesota would continue, you know, paying for its share of coyote, and you know the cost, depending on how it chooses to dispatch the units, some of those costs might change, but
mm-hmm.
it's still receiving capacity credits, so there's still benefit.
So you wouldn't have to go through any sort of contortions to use it. Minnesota wouldn't disallow you from using it or in your capacity needs for them, in your PRM.
That is what we are proposing, yes.
Yeah.
You know, this still needs, you know, approvals.
As long as they you offset 100% by 2040 with renewable. And it's renewable, not carbon-free.
It is carbon. That's
carbon-free.
It's carbon-free. Yeah.
Okay.
So nuclear qualifies, you know, hydro qualifies. There's a list.
Yeah.
And there's still some uncertainties of how this is going to get implemented. There's a couple dockets that are open in Minnesota, so some of those details are still
mm-hmm.
yet to get ironed out as far as what exactly qualifies and how do you show compliance, but the gist is there.
So in a hypothetical world, you could purchase the North Dakota RECs for the purpose of satisfying the Minnesota REC requirements?
The way the rule is written, that's how we have interpreted it, and that's going to get clearly decided on by the commission.
Yeah, there are different perspectives, like any statute that gets passed, and you have to flesh out the application to it. There are some entities that would take a more restrictive view that I'm sure we'll hear from them in the mm-hmm. dockets that are scheduled. And that'll play out, I think, toward the end of 24 is when that's teed up. So.
Yeah, this next slide here we've already started covering, but you know, again, that last bullet point, just want to draw attention to that. You guys are a very big stakeholder in helping us just navigate this, and we recognize this is a pretty significant change. You know, we're anticipating a lot of work with you all and staff moving forward. Happy to have as many conversations as needed to make sure that we're all up to speed and making sure we're all on the same page.
Can I say good luck?
That is welcomed, yes. Appreciate that. Any other thoughts on this topic? And if more questions come up before we transition to the highlight, we can come back to it as well.
The highlight being
Mark's environmental.
I've talked to Joe Sullivan a few times about these problems and challenges between our states. And I don't necessarily see a way that our commissions can necessarily work together to make it easier. I think they're just bound by the law in their state, and they have to figure out how to make that work. So to the extent that they work with us, it might actually make it harder. But if there is ever a way that you think it would be helpful for the commissions to talk to each other or have the staff talk to each other or whatever, I think we should be open to that, to see if there's some sort of, you know, rather than we dig our heels and they dig their heels, and, you know, we all want to serve our customers reliably and affordably. They have different policy restrictions than we do. So I don't know. I think that if there is any value to that, you should at least let us know.
Thank you, Matt.
I have two things before we move to the next topic, then. Unless you had any response to that.
No, I just point appreciate that. Okay. We'll keep that in mind, yeah.
So a lot of what you've said and feels persuasive as you say it, but it's, you know, well, the modeling is picking up this, or the modeling suggests that. And I know it's an important tool, but then I often keep running through my mind, yeah, well, the modeling is as accurate as the inputs that you built your model on. I'm curious, years ago when Otter Tail came here wanting to shut down Hoot Lake and build Astoria, did your modeling pick up that you would need the secondary fuel source within such a short time frame?
Is it right if I get into that?
Maybe that's a different. Yeah, we actually have a case on that. So,
yeah.
Good point. I'm sorry.
No,
I shouldn't have asked.
You can answer that question in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I will answer you in 3 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, any other questions you can tee up for me?
I'm curious.
The other thing, so a lot of this discussion is about, you know, the costs and the state mandates and such. But at the end of the day, while those are really, really important, after Storm Uri in Texas, we got another example, and they've happened before over the years in different places, where really the costs of keeping the energy flowing weren't near as important as the costs associated with a failure, where utility executives were fired, utility regulators were fired, and far more importantly, lives were lost and fortunes were lost. And so as you kind of model this stuff and figure out, you know, a bifurcated planning system. But at the end of the day, if it's the North Dakota strategy that succeeds or fails based on the production of a coal plant and a couple wind farms, or, you know, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe our coal plant fails, but the solar and wind is working and batteries are working great in Minnesota. But the same amount of people are going to be able to be served. And how we develop these resource plans, am I right that it will have nothing to do with the resource plans? The system will serve whoever it can serve at any given time. There's not going to be any decisions based on state lines as to who gets service if there's not enough energy available.
Yeah, that's correct. Electrons don't recognize borders. You know, MISO handles the dispatch of all the units. And
So in this bifurcated resource plan, we're really only dealing with the least important of the factors, not the most important, which is the reliability.
I can't disagree with you on that, but it is the situation, yeah, you know, that we find ourselves in right now. And, you know, we didn't come to this proposal lightly. You know, we've looked at a lot of different avenues. And you're right, back to your point on, you know, modeling is only as good as the inputs you put into it. And that's certainly not what we're basing this proposal on. Is, you know, there's modeling is an important piece, but there's a lot of other factors that we consider. You know, we take reliability and affordability very serious. And we feel like this path forward is our best option to continue providing, you know, safe, clean, reliable electricity. And is it the perfect path forward? Probably not. And, you know, we're open for, you know, ideas, but this is where we're at today.
So is it safe to say, Nate, that the green box on page 11, that's sort of, in your view, the company's view, sort of the least regrets, that's ultimately what you want to kind of get the nod on or propose?
That's where we were with the supplemental preferred plan and for this IRP, but recognizing that it would be difficult to get everybody on board with that. What we are suggesting today is, you know, moving forward, we're going to bifurcate our resource planning.
Oh, so you're saying Minnesota wouldn't go with this, basically.
Say what?
That's what I heard.
You know,
it would get, well, you said it would be difficult to get everybody on board with this. So, like, say we got on board.
Yep.
I'm not saying that's easy or difficult. I'm just saying, say we did. Is that something you envision Minnesota would get on board with or not? The green box.
I think they potentially, this, maybe they would like more. You know, we have a hearing with them scheduled in January,
mm-hmm,
to get the commission's viewpoint on this.
So, okay, so this is what you're proposing, plus the bifurcated, or what?
So, it's here, you got a good, clear answer. I could waffle for a while. But.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're not bringing it at home in any way.
Yeah.
I think the way it's framed is, going forward, it's clear that this kind of bifurcated plan will be necessary. What we have in front of, in our supplemental plan on file here and file in our other jurisdictions, it's, as Nate's laid out there, I'm not sure which column.
Is that the Minnesota, North Dakota one in the back? That's the plan.
The plan, the supplemental, key parts of the supplemental plan right now, of course, Astoria Station, LNG, the 200 megawatts of wind and solar, and then the Coyote Station withdrawal only in the event of a non-routine large capital investment in that.
So what's
it? It seems like page 11, 2040, Coyote withdrawal would be that. No?
Yeah. How's your time?
Just to avoid any further waffling, maybe, but Matt Olson, just to read it again, I think the difference here is in the timing.
Yeah.
So in North Dakota and Minnesota, there's different procedural paths for approval of these projects. When we're looking at a five-year timeframe that's in the green box there, we're going to be back in front of both of our commissions before we get all the way through that time frame. So, you know, specific projects in North Dakota, we'd be back in for an ADP for those specific projects. I think that's where you need to think about it for today. Know that we'll be back in if a bifurcated resource planning would be an outcome of this proceeding. We'll be back in with that in front of North Dakota for things going forward, and any specific resources, we would be coming in with an ADP request for those specific resources. In Minnesota, because there's not an advanced termination prudence process, the IRP serves a different function. The five-year time frame is a bit more meaningful there, so the resources in that time frame, I think you can think of as separately from what you're approving in this process here. So you wouldn't need to say that you'd need to approve all those in that green box today or even in this IRP in North Dakota at all.
Right. I get that, because we don't really even haven't even decided if we have an approval process or what our ultimate outcome is going to be from this. But just so I can understand, what plan is it that you want us to be evaluating? Is it the green boxes, the preferred plan? Or is there a bifurcated North Dakota plan already that you want us to look at?
What we're proposing is our next IRP coming with a bifurcated plan.
Okay. The next one.
Yeah.
And for now, we're supposed to do what? Look at the preferred plan?
This is what the system-wide modeling is. You look at it knowing that we would like to reevaluate to make sure that each state is getting what you know is best for them.
So we're on hold. until what I heard is that's what you'd want, and you're going to submit another supplement.
We're not thinking to supplement this IRP. You know, this is the way. This is challenging. This is the plan that we were working towards, but now we recognize that it is getting just too difficult to navigate these jurisdictional challenges, and we are proposing that moving forward, because again, like Matt alluded to, you know, if we wouldn't bring an ADP right now on these resources, when you look at the Dakota only runs, it is pushing that timing of those renewables back.
The first resource on this list is 2027. Right, so other than the ADP for a story that's already pending before you.
Sure.
So between now and 2027, we'll be back in front of you in the IRP process, and we can establish what the plan is for North Dakota from there.
I see.
Let me take a shot
okay.
at yeah.
paraphrasing.
Okay.
And maybe we can just get a yes or no. The green box is essentially what you're proposing for this IRP.
Yes.
But you're making it known to us that in the future, in a subsequent IRP, you're likely going to need to bifurcate.
Yeah.
And looking at the time frame of 2027.
Yeah, or whatever the...
Yep.
Whatever the statutory time frame is for us to file our next one.
3 years.
Yep.
Okay. So would it be still helpful for us, though, I would assume, as a state, to provide feedback on this plan? Because you can share
yep.
that with your other
jurisdictions. That would be helpful, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
We brought it on home.
We're all
good
on
group
the same
effort.
Page. Pending further discussion.
Now, can you confuse us?
Yeah.
I was going to say, maybe we found something more confusing than environmental regulation. I don't know. We'll take a poll at the end of this. It's certainly never straightforward. So, Nate, I sensed some sarcasm when you said this would be the highlight. So just putting that out there. Also, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that I really enjoy the Kelly Green in my background here, too. So,
nice.
Yes, that's very nice. So it's been an extremely
active year in terms of regulatory activity from the Environmental Protection Agency and the number of rules being proposed and finalized that could impact the power sector. I could speak about many of these rules, but I thought I would just highlight three in particular that, you know, we're kind of monitoring for Kyle Station when we start talking about, you know, major non-routine capital investments and future of resource planning. The first one actually kind of contradicts a little bit what I just said when touch on regional haze, because there has not been much of any activity on the regional haze front when it comes to national scale activity and the EPA. We have to go back over a year ago when the state of North Dakota submitted its state implementation plan to EPA, and since that time it has been very quiet. EPA did make a very quick completeness determination that just said, yes, you know, your plan checks all the boxes in terms of the information we were expecting. They made that within a couple weeks of North Dakota submitting its plan. But since that time, have not heard anything.
Is regional haze and good neighbor the same thing?
They are not the same thing. Shoot. Yeah.
All right, you don't have to go into
okay.
the differences.
Okay, that's much time do we have? I could take up all night here. So since it has been over a year since EPA made its completeness determination, they had a statutory obligation where they were supposed to act within 12 months. They did not. It's very common. Same thing happened in round one of regional haze. But because of that, there has been a complaint filed against EPA now by a few environmental organizations that will, we believe, result in, you know, setting a schedule to compel EPA to act. And that was not exclusive just to North Dakota. There were 33 other states that were lumped into this complaint. So that's a fairly recent development. And, you know, potentially in the next couple months, maybe we'll have some type of a court schedule, not a no-win schedule. That's my best guess. EPA could be behind the scenes working on this and come up with some type of proposed action, but we haven't had an indication of that yet. So as a co-owner group, we have a kind of a regional haze committee that's been formed for some time. You know, we're on record supporting North Dakota's plan, which would not require additional upgrades at Coyote Station. You know, one of the key reasons why North Dakota is not proposing additional emission restrictions for round two is, as a state, it looks like they are already on path to hit the reasonable progress targets for round two, and then the additional costs of the environmental controls, along with very minimal visibility benefits, didn't pass muster. And this picture is actually, this is something I just took on my phone on a family trip out to Medora this past summer. Very beautiful day. I wish it'd been blue sky, but just goes to show that we have excellent visibility in North Dakota when I guess we don't have any wildfire impacts, obviously. So, but clearly, if, you know, EPA were to disagree, they would have to propose something called a federal implementation plan that would go out for a notice and comment before it could be finalized. But, you know, potentially there's a wide range of outcomes there. We had retained Sargent and Lundy to do it's called something called a four-factor analysis of all these different environmental controls, you know, obviously ranging from zero or minimal costs up to, you know, installing new technology, which would be in the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, of which Otter Tail would be obviously a 35% share of that upgrade. So more to come. We've talked about for regional haze for many, many years, over a decade now at this point, and it's still in the news and something we're closely monitoring over the next year or so. All right, so that's rule number one. What's behind door number two is the EPA has proposed changes to the mercury and air toxic standards in April of this year. And the key change there, a couple key changes. Number one, they are proposing to eliminate, there's existing lignite subcategory for mercury emissions that they're proposing to eliminate. And so lignite fired plants would have to meet the same standard as other coal types. And they're also planning to strengthen the particulate matter emission standard. I mean, I'll say somewhat good news here is that Coyote does employ EPA's presumptive control technologies already for both mercury and particulate matter. We did submit extensive comments. We worked with the Lincoln Energy Council and outside council as well to put together some comments. I mean, I think we put together some very strong technical data showing that EPA's assumption that lignite coal and subbituminous coals are similar enough and control mercury similar enough is false. I guess we're somewhat fortunate. We operate Big Stone Plant in South Dakota, fired on subbituminous coal, uses similar control technologies, and you can see clearly that you're not able to meet the same reductions on an apples-for-apples basis. So we're hoping they listen to us, but we have heard nothing back. We're anticipating a final rule, you know, certainly in the first half of next year, potentially even sooner than that. So we'll see where that goes. Again, we're cautiously optimistic that we have the right technology, depending on how low they go. It's just that, you know, we certainly would need to use more of our reagent to control mercury. More testing would be needed, certainly, if they were to make that change. So another big one that we are looking at, and again, working with our North Dakota counterparts in terms of what's to come on that rule.
Regulatory limbo.
Yeah. And then last, but certainly not least, I mean, I suppose I could have led with this rule, because if this rule were finalized, kind of what I just talked about, maybe doesn't matter. Because under the greenhouse gas rule that I assume at this point you've heard plenty about and perhaps are already quite familiar with, that under Section 1 of the Clean Air Act, that EPA proposes rulemaking that, again, we anticipate they will finalize again in the first half of next year. Don't know if they'll make changes or not. But under that rule, if you plan to continue operation beyond 2030 without any type of set retirement date, you would have to have carbon capture sequestration installed by 2030, capturing, you know, roughly 90% of your carbon emissions. So we submitted extensive comments on the rule, you know, saying that, you know, we disagree with that determination that carbon capture represents the best system of emission reduction. We don't believe it's adequately demonstrated or achievable or even the best system. You know, we think they really missed the mark on analyzing impacts to grid reliability, because if you're retiring, you know, your existing coal that doesn't install CCS and that essentially is retired by 2035 if you don't do anything, and large gas plants greater than 300 megawatts and operate above 50% capacity factor, those are typically your combined cycle units, they also have to choose from a hydrogen path or a carbon capture path. So for retiring all that, we just felt like they did not clearly do a good enough job looking at reliability impacts. And so and this is an area I know MISO and SPP and other markets have been heavily involved in commenting to EPA. And EPA did, I will say, just today actually publish in the Federal Register a notice where they're asking for more information about reliability and potential reliability mechanisms. And so, you know, we're hoping that MISO will continue to engage and industry will continue to engage in some ideas there and expressing some concerns. So,
since you guys are here and we're talking about this, some of these reliability mechanisms have seemed just sort of superficial in my mind, but I might be looking at it wrong. So I'm curious from the, you know, owner-operator standpoint, when you're looking at what the EPA is doing, like, you don't look at just one rule. You're looking at all these because they all impact Coyote, for example, and Big Stone. What kind of a reliability, like, message would you need to get, and by what time period to not retire something? You know what I'm saying? It feels like there's this notion out there that they can have this reliability safety valve, but how I see that happening, it would be so far down the road from now that you're getting your messages from folks like us and your other regulators about what you should be investing in today and, you know, in the next couple of years. Those decisions affect these units. And maybe in 2030 they decide, oh yeah, we need that unit, but you've already gone down the path of retiring it. So what sort of reliability mechanisms do you think actually would work?
Yeah, it's to your point, it's very difficult. And, you know, we've tried to stress as an industry trying to matching up some of these compliance timelines because they're not on alignment. So regional haze potentially is end of 2028, a little bit to be determined. You know, some of the other states have good neighbor rule obligations in the mid-2020s. You've got effluent limit guidelines, which are sometimes 2029, 2028 to 2030, and so they're all a little bit different. And if they require, say, regional haze investment decision, you know, those take years to implement, right? So you kind of have to decide a few years ahead of time whether or not you make that investment or not. So to your point, you're kind of already chosen your path by the time you get close to your compliance deadline. Yeah. And then it creates a lot of uncertainty when you have a greenhouse gas rule that, sure, you're complying with regional haze, but that does you no good if you don't also start carbon capture by that time frame. So I don't have a great answer to your question because you're right. You kind of put yourself out there already for that. And, you know, to the extent that you're going to get an early signal or not from MISO, if Nate or not has any more insight into some of the kind of their, you know, reliability evaluations, but you may not get that until you're, you know, close to that date, if you will, of retirement, if that's where you ultimately end up. So what we're also hoping for is, you know, we've tried to advocate for, you know, there needs to be more compliance flexibility, you know, in this rule. So mm-hmm. is there something else that can be done from a regional perspective, from an averaging or something like that? So if you have, you know, one state that's going further, and can that work? So we're hoping to see something more about that in the final rule. And I will say, this is probably the third time I they don't let me come too often to these kind of meetings, but I'm sure this is at least probably the third time I've come talking about a different greenhouse gas rule. We had Clean Power Plan. This is sometimes called Clean Power Plan 2.0. Before that, we had Affordable Clean Energy Rule. So, you know, there's some time between finalization, litigation. States under this rule as proposed have 2 years from a final rule to submit a state implementation plan to EPA. So there still is some runway in this thing for sure. So I don't anticipate this will be the last time, you know, you're mm-hmm. providing an update. But clearly this one, I have to say, went further than we were even anticipating.
So do you even have tools to evaluate? Like, okay, so if we can get through MATS, like what would we be looking at in terms of costs, potential worst case scenario, and then we've got the regional haze, maybe things are okay. So do you have tools that can help even analyze those various layers? Like if we get through that, we might be looking at this worst case scenario, then this worst case scenario, and then we've got the greenhouse gas rule on top of it. So if we've made all these investments and then got stuck with greenhouse gas, you know, how do you even as a company evaluate those?
Right. Yeah. It's modeling. Well, I wanted to say that and I was like, oh, it comes down to some of those inputs. With that said, we've got a great history, I guess, or our history in terms of making some of these environmental upgrades too. So we have experience making the investment at you know, Big Soul Plant. It was largely driven from Regional Haze Round 1 and MATS. We made investment at Kyle Station as part of Regional Haze Round 1 too. We did make NOx upgrades there, you know, a lot different scale. So I would just say we have been through this before, you know, whether it was 8 to 10 years ago when we went through a lot of these rules, and, you know, navigated way through. So we've got a track record. It is complicated, and it's difficult to sometimes make those decisions, big decisions, when you also don't know, okay, what's next. So again, it's really important that EPA, you know, if they move forward, the extent they can harmonize these timelines, so we can make those decisions as a whole versus making one and then getting hit with something unexpected a couple years down the line.
So with the regional haze and the mercury and air toxics, you talked about coyotes specifically.
Yeah.
On greenhouse gases, are we still talking about coyotes specifically? Or
this is
big stone?
This is
the exact same bolt.
Yeah, this rule, the entire industry is in the kind of the exact same bolt. So it's not, you know, not specific to Coyote Station or any other North Dakota plant, but the coal plants would all have the same standards here. So this is a nationally applicable rule and issue. So again, we submitted comments, but I'd say they're more broader scale than, you know, the regional haze and MATS, which those are at this point more coyote specific.
What's the useful life today of Big Stone?
So that one we have through 2046. So we upgraded the air quality control system there in 2016 and had a 30-year life is what we had assumed for those controls.
That was in 2016?
Yeah, where we...
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. We have to put that in our comments room. Any future comments? Because that, I mean, we haven't even gotten 10 years out of that. Sheesh. And that, so Big Stone, the only hope for that under EPA's current rule would be carbon capture. I mean, but there's no storage down there.
Correct. You know, again, that was part of our comments. So, I mean, they underestimated the infrastructure needed, right? So, you know, the pipeline to run up to somewhere like North Dakota, you're very familiar with a carbon pipeline and the expense and ease of.
Easy.
Putting that in, right?
The
right.
Line.
So.
Oh wait.
Sorry. So those were the three rules I was gonna again highlight. There's been there's a ton of other that we're tracking, whether it's ambient air quality standards, coal combustion residuals, you know, water related rules, even, you know. There's endangered species rules that are out there that could impact. So there's lots out there. It did feel like a bit of an unprecedented year, even looking back 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so we anticipate a very busy first half of 24. That's it.
All right. Last slide here. Looking ahead, is we're at a point now where this list down to two bullet points. Go back a few months when you're presenting an IRP topics, there'd be quite a few more here. So we're getting to the end, which is, you know, it's been a process. We'll be back here a few more weeks on the Astoria on-site fuel ADP hearing, and then in Minnesota, the IRP hearing's been scheduled for that first week, January 4th. Culmination, Gary?
That's not an official date, but that's what we anticipate. The first part of January will be before the Minnesota Commission on our IRP there.
You don't have a hearing scheduled?
They don't lock in officially until you get a little closer to that date, but that's indications we have of your very early January.
Ooh, that should be 2024, I see.
Yes.
Yes.
Feels.
And is the IRP that you're going to propose to them on January 4th, if that's the day they choose, what's in the green box here? Or are you going with the more the Minnesota plan for that IRP?
That's what's in front of them today.
The green box.
Correct.
Plan.
And as far as, you know, there may be developments that occur in Minnesota between now and then, we're looking at things. So I'd like to leave it there.
Okay.
I mean, what's do they approve the IRPs or
Minnesota Commissioner? Yes, Minnesota statutorily they can accept, reject, or modify. So they have a great deal of latitude with our IRPs.
And historically, when would you think that they that you would know the result of their rejection, acceptance, or modification?
Commissioner Crispin, what we understand, typically there'll be a day for a hearing to flesh out the issues before the commission, and then they would go maybe a week later, they would have deliberations. So all within the first part of January.
Yep. And there's interveners and stuff in those?
Yes, Commissioner Fedorchuk. Minnesota, statutorily, the Department of Commerce comments on our modeling, and they can make recommendations. The department or the Office of Attorney General is authorized to comment and is charged with protecting the interests of residential ratepayers. And then we have a consortium of environmentalist groups that the clean energy organizations that have intervened. So a little different scenario in Minnesota. Mm-hmm.
Extensive. I was just talking to Joe last week about it, you know, their process, and especially with the interveners and
I'd like to say the more the merrier, but it doesn't work out that way sometimes. Yeah. So
yeah. All right, are there any final questions? Appreciate the opportunity to come here today, and you know, anticipate a lot of discussions moving forward.
Does anyone from PSC have anything?
Maybe just one general question. I know you haven't run the modeling as a bifurcated model yet, but it seems that if you run a bifurcated model between Minnesota and North Dakota, that I guess without that wholly integrated type of planning, that you'd absent, a unique transaction with maybe another entity, that we'd largely end up with smaller, more incremental generation additions, which I would presume to be more renewables as well. Is that what you'd anticipate?
So we have, you know, if you go back to slide, whatever was that? This slide here was North and South Dakota only.
Mm-hmm.
A bifurcated model, and so we'll have similar resources available to the model to select. You know, we have battery storage, solar in 25 megawatt increments, wind in 50 megawatt increments. Then we'd have a LM6000, you know, 50 megawatt CT in the model, and then other,
sure,
you know, go through before each IRP and flesh out what's reasonably out there. But yeah, you're right that each jurisdiction would likely pick a smaller quantity of resources. And if there's opportunity where all of our jurisdictions agree that in roughly the same time there's a wind need, then we would try to put that together with one project, try to capture some economies of scale benefits when it works out.
Thank you.
I don't have any more. Thank you guys for all your good information today and discussion.
Okay. So for evidence today, we have the recording of the discussion, as well as this handout that was on the screen, and as well as on paper. Are there any objections to that evidence becoming part of the official record?
It would be from an advocacy staff if there was.
No, none from us.
Carrie?
Oh.
Are there any objections to the evidence?
No.
I thought you were thinking that.
Oh,
like,
boy. We've never had this.
This sounds troubling.
Oh, it sorry. Gets even more interesting.
My stomach was rumbling.
Nice to end with a laugh. So the evidence here, along with, I'm sure, voluminous and forthcoming information, will become part of the evidence upon which a decision will be made. Are there any other matters for the record? Seeing none, this informal hearing is closed. Thank you, everyone.